It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Tuesday, the state Senate passed legislation that would make Wisconsin the 33rd state to legalize online sports betting, sending the bill to Governor Evers' desk. It's unclear whether Evers will sign it into law. He said yesterday that he's waiting to speak with tribal leaders, including those who haven't backed the effort, before making a final decision. The bill would allow sports betting online if the servers hosting the bets are located on tribal lands. Lawmakers from both parties and some tribal officials have supported the bill, arguing that it would bring in millions of dollars for Wisconsin and its tribes and legalize betting that's already happening with offshore sports books or prediction markets like Kalshi. But not everyone is on board. A recent Marquette Law School poll found that nearly two-thirds of Wisconsin voters oppose legalizing online sports betting. And religious groups like the Wisconsin Catholic Conference and Wisconsin Family Action registered in opposition to the bill. For more on this issue, we turn to Jim Harrison, an addiction and substance abuse counselor in New Berlin who treats patients with severe gambling problems. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Rose Blazinski is here, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. Rose, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Rose, what are your initial thoughts on legalizing online sports betting in Wisconsin?
Well, the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling maintains neutrality on legalized gambling, but what I can say is certainly when gambling accessibility increases, that does increase the risk of more people becoming addicted to gambling.
So what would change at the council if this legislation becomes law, if Governor Evers signs it?
We would continue with what we always do. You know, we have a 24-hour helpline. We have resources for people who have a gambling problem. I think eventually we will see, as we are already a little bit, an increase in calls to our helpline, which is great because then that means people are hearing about us and making a call.
So you think there might be an increase to your helpline if you see online sports betting legalized in Wisconsin?
Well, again, it's the accessibility issue. When you increase accessibility, you have people who may be doing the sports betting or whatever now where they maybe wouldn't have in the past. But the easier it is to access, we see more people trying to do it. So that does increase the risk of being addicted.
Jim, you treat patients with severe gambling problems. How would allowing online sports betting affect those people?
Well, each person is different. Some people, it would increase their gambling. Some people, they'd continue where they are. Some people, they would just start gambling. So there's no cookie cutter answer to this. Every individual is different. Just like with any, you know, counseling issue, they're not all the same.
Not all the same. And, you know, a majority of people who place bets, that they don't fall into gambling addiction. How do people develop an unhealthy relationship with placing bets?
Well, many times the worst thing that can happen is they can win a lot of money the first time. Then they think, well, I'm going to get some more. Well, what they do is continue gambling, then start losing and losing and losing. And eventually, you know, it's called chasing their losses to the point where it becomes not just financially, but it affects the relationships, affects the family, sometimes their physical health, certainly their emotional and mental health. So it does escalate. But like I said, the worst thing that can happen with some people is winning that big, you know, pot in the beginning.
Mm. Rose, your organization is kicking off its annual conference today, you know, bringing people together who are concerned about problem gambling. What have you been hearing from other experts you've been in contact with about this bill to legalize online sports betting?
Well, we actually have a couple different presenters today and tomorrow who are talking specifically about the sports betting. I think there's, you know, legalized or not legalized, people who are going to choose to gamble are going to gamble no matter what. So there's always a concern, again, that 5 to 7% of the population that has some kind of a gambling problem, that's where we put our focus.
Hmm. You know, James, you are leading a panel at this conference on identifying and treating financial problems that result from problem gambling. What kind of problems do you find that patients most frequently run into?
Well, obviously, a loss of money. in addition to that, it certainly affects the family. They can't pay their bills. They max out their credit cards. They're always short of money. They always want to get more money. So how do they try to get more money? Obviously by gambling. So it not only affects them financially, but like I said before, certainly emotionally and with the family. Sometimes it splits up families.
I wonder.
So there's many, many different ways that it can affect people.
I wonder, too, if online sports betting poses different risks with access than, say, spending a day at the casino and making, you know, a day of it. Do you see different risk levels there?
Well, it certainly makes it easier to gamble, you know, than they did before. You know, it's not offshore betting or anything like that. They can do it, you know, just walk across the street and start gambling. Mm-hmm. So it makes it easier. And that, I guess that's the big part.
We are talking about a bill that is heading to the governor's desk, which would legalize online sports betting in Wisconsin. Rose Blazinski is executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. And Jim Harrison is an addiction and substance abuse counselor in New Berlin who treats patients dealing with gambling problems. Rose, proponents of this bill, they've argued that online sports betting should be legalized because it's already happening through prediction markets like Kalshi or Robinhood or offshore sports books. What is your response to that? What do you see?
Well, again, you know, we maintain the neutrality of that, but people will gamble. I think I said earlier, too, people will gamble if it's legalized, if it's not legalized. If you have someone that has a gambling issue, they are going to find a way no matter what. And then one thing I just want to add with everything that Jim had said is, unfortunately, with problem gamblers, very often suicide can be a high risk for them as well. And so we always pay attention to that and try to be on alert.
Jim, what might be signs that someone is really, really struggling with gambling and that it could take a serious turn?
Well, obviously, they're missing work. If they're younger, they're not going to school. You know, college students, it's affecting their whole lives. And again, each individual is different. It depends how serious it is or how minor it is, if there is such a thing as minor gambling for some people. But it's, you know, as I keep saying, there's no cookie cutter answer to this. Everyone is different. The big thing is they need a support system, someone they can turn to that they feel comfortable talking with, whether it's a family member, whether it's a counselor, whether it's a clergy person, someone in their life that will be supportive, not shaming, condemning, judgmental, but help them to get through this.
Oh, because you could see that, you know, maybe they are ashamed or maybe they, you know, feel some apprehension to go to their support system and divulge that this has been happening. Do you see that stigma?
Oh, definitely. Guilt is a big factor there. You know, they don't want to share with other people because, you know, they know what they've done and how it affected the family. And like I said, they don't want to be shamed, condemned, judged. They just want help, but they have to seek the help too. And that's where we come in, you know, as therapists or other, you know, people that can help them out. They have to turn to somebody and they have to want to change also. And that's the big thing. There has to be change.
So, James, there is recent research on gambling in Pennsylvania found most people with gambling problems, they don't seek treatment or other assistance. And what unique challenges do people with gambling addictions face that make treatment relatively rare?
Well, part of the problem is there aren't a lot of gambling counselors out there. Gambling, you know, issues are different than substance issues. You know, a lot of counselors will say, too, you know, an addiction is an addiction is an addiction. Not necessarily. The gambling addiction or disorder or whatever you want to call it is different than substance issues. If you walk down the street and see somebody who's totally high on something, you'd be able to identify that person as someone who is under the influence of something. If you see someone who walked out of the casino that just lost $100,000, you couldn't tell that they are a pathological gambler. So everyone is different. They're all the same. The same is they have some problems. The difference is what the problem is and the severity of the problem. And again, that's where we as counselors come in and speak to them and talk to them. And okay, let's talk about this. What changes would you like to make? And that's the big thing. They have to want to change. I can't change anybody. I'm not that powerful. If I were, they come in, I flip a switch. Okay, you're fixed. Next person come in. Doesn't work that way. So we have to work together.
Rose, some tribal leaders, including the chairwoman of the Lake Superior Board of Chippewa Indians, Nicole Boyd, says this move was key to maintaining a primary income source for tribes and benefits the state financially as well. How do you view the trade-off between regulating sports bets and what's a vital business source?
Well, I think we have to just really, yeah, it may be a positive income source. We also have to look at the percent of the population that has an issue that will or are addicted and make sure there's resources for those people to kind of balance out people who can do it for fun and are never going to have a problem versus people who run into issues. You know, like Jim said, there aren't a lot of gambling counselors. There's not a lot of resources. So it becomes very difficult for somebody once they finally do decide to reach out for help.
Well, Rose and Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rose Belezinski is executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. Jim Harrison is an addiction and substance abuse counselor in New Berlin. We've been talking about legislation headed to Governor Evers' desk that would make online sports betting legal in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Health Services offers support for gambling disorders. That number is 800-426-2535. Once again, 800-426-2535. President Trump has promised to protect the Great Lakes from invasive carp, but is holding up funding for a project to keep them out. Hear from the Alliance for the Great Lakes on the threat.
The states have been really on the front lines of trying to make sure that these carp get stopped before they can establish in Lake Michigan and the rest of the lakes.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Testing of autonomous vehicles is something you would expect to see in Silicon Valley. But how about Lake Superior? A couple of tech companies in Duluth have an ambitious vision to do just that, from submarines with no pilots in the Big Lake to autonomous machines underground on Minnesota's Iron Range. Dan Crocker has more.
John McGunigal is showing off a high-tech buoy his company is building in a workshop in West Duluth.
This is what we build right now, and we put out in Lake Superior. So
it's equipped with an array of sensors and hydrophones to measure sound underwater in Lake Superior.
This kind of, for lack of a better term, sees underwater, right?
McGunigal is a retired Navy submarine pilot and co-founder of Spear AI. The company has deployed 4 buoys in Lake Superior with plans for several more this spring. It's the beginning of what McGunigal hopes will eventually become a destination for tech companies to test autonomous marine vehicles. Think driverless boats and small unmanned submarines. Here's how it would work. Autonomous vehicles, whether they're robo-taxis or military drones, need to be able to navigate the world around them. They do that through artificial intelligence models that have been trained to recognize objects they see around them. Spear has developed a tool to do that underwater, to take all that acoustic data it gathers in Lake Superior and label the sound waves. And they're working with another company in Duluth called Anno AI to process that data so that AI systems can understand what they're hearing.
They essentially draw a shape around different parts of the image and tell the system, this is a fishing boat, this is a trawler, This is an ore carrier.
That's Stephen Witt, a former CIA intelligence officer who's now CEO of Anno AI. He and others say Lake Superior is the perfect place for this kind of work, in part because there's a huge range of geographic and climate conditions.
It's deep, it's cold, it has Arctic-like conditions, but you don't have to go to the Arctic, right? Because we've got all that ice out there.
Catherine O'Reilly directs the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth.
So there's a lot of potential to use Lake Superior as a place for testing and assessing novel technologies.
It's also in the middle of the country, away from the prying eyes of America's adversaries, which is important when testing defense technology. Both Anno and Spear have secured federal military contracts, in addition to millions in private capital. Meanwhile, Anno AI is also working in North Dakota to create a test range for aerial drones, where machines could potentially fly from the deck of a ship in Duluth to make a delivery in Bismarck. And Witt says the company is also exploring using abandoned mines on the Iron Range.
We need to test and understand things like, how does a warhead impact an unmanned surface vessel? We don't and can't blow things up in Lake Superior for environmental reasons, but a flooded pit mine that's no longer being used could be a really good place to do that testing.
Witt says there's also opportunity to train autonomous systems how to work in deep underground environments by testing them in abandoned mine shafts. Some employees have raised concerns about partnering with companies with defense contracts that are testing military technology and about possible environmental impacts on the lake. To fully build out a test range would require significant infrastructure, including docks on the lake for boats, warehouse space, and a range of sensors in the lake. McGonigal and Witt hope to see that built out over the next decade. If that happens, Witt believes it'll draw other technology companies to set up shop in Duluth. It may sound like science fiction to some, but Walmart is already delivering purchases with drones in Dallas, Atlanta, and other cities. Autonomous vehicles are evacuating wounded soldiers from the battlefield in Ukraine. And if this vision takes hold, northern Minnesota could play a role in developing and testing future autonomous technologies. For the Upper Midwest Newsroom, I'm Dan Crocker in Duluth.
The Upper Midwest Newsroom is a public media collaboration among Wisconsin, North and South Dakota, and Minnesota, made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is Wisconsin Today. An army of invasive carp is moving up the Illinois River toward Lake Michigan. Currently about 50 miles from the lake, these fish would completely dominate the Lake Michigan ecosystem. A plan to stop the fish has been in the works for years. Planning for the $1 billion Brandon Road Interbasin Project began in 2020, but the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has paused funding for the project. We wanted to understand how the invasive carp would affect the Lake Michigan ecosystem and how it can be stopped. Joel Brummeyer is president and CEO of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Joel, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much.
What threat do invasive carp species pose to the Great Lakes?
So the bighead and silver carp species that are moving towards Lake Michigan are large, and they breed and feed better than all the native fish in the Great Lakes. And so think of it as a fish that can come in and can take out the base of the food web, eat up all the food, can reproduce really quickly, and then outcompete all those native fish like whitefish and yellow perch and things that people rely on and enjoy fishing for here in the Great Lakes. And that's why there are such great concern to the Great Lakes states, because we've seen this story before, right? We've seen the impacts of invasive species and how they can decimate our fisheries and our outdoor way of life. And so the states have been really on the front lines of trying to make sure that these carp get stopped before they can establish in Lake Michigan and the rest of the lakes.
When you talk about altering the base of the food system of that ecosystem in the Great Lakes, do these invasive carp have any predators that are known?
Not here in the Great Lakes. And that's one of the characteristics of an invasive species, is they are from another part of the world and they go to another place where they don't have those natural predators. And so they quickly outpace the size of any fish in the Great Lakes that would consume them. And so unfortunately, once they're in a body of water and they start reproducing, they really quickly become impossible to get rid of.
You've mentioned other invasives here. I mean, we've seen in Lake Michigan the zebra mussels impact, the sea lamprey impact. How do carp compare in the amount of damage they could do to the lakes and the overall ecosystem?
I would put carp right up there with sea lamprey, zebra, and quagga mussels in terms of their potential impact on the Great Lakes. So this is a huge red flag that these fish are swimming towards Lake Michigan. People who were around when the zebra mussels first took hold remember how they just coated everything and quickly just changed how the Great Lakes ecosystem operated. Sea lamprey, which grab onto all the sides of fish like lake trout and other large predator fish that are really desirable for fishing, and kind of literally suck the life out of them. Carp, because they are so good at eating, they could quickly remove a lot of food from the Great Lakes and have just as big of an impact as things like sea lamprey and zebra mussels, particularly in places like Green Bay, which is a sort of a, what we call a nutrient-rich part of the Great Lakes. It's a place with lots of plants, lots of food, and unfortunately, really great habitat for bighead and silver carp.
So timeline here, how quickly, if they get in, how quickly could the fish overwhelm a Great Lake or even overwhelm the Bay of Green Bay?
Unfortunately, with invasive species, it's really hard to say exactly when the population will explode, right? Mm-hmm. And by the time that happens, it's already too late. So once you see evidence of a large population, they're already here, they're already established, and getting rid of them is next to impossible. And so what we know is that we've got to prevent them from getting in the first place, and that once they're established somewhere, it's almost certain they're going to spread throughout the rest of the Great Lakes, especially in those bays, those rivers, inland lakes, places where they're going to find really good habitat. That could take a year. It could take 5 or 10. But unfortunately, if they do establish, you know, history tells us that they will continue to spread across the Great Lakes Basin. And Lake Michigan, of course, is the first frontier that we hope they don't get to.
Is there any evidence that invasive carp are already in the Great Lakes?
There's been some what we call eDNA, environmental DNA evidence of the presence of bighead and silver carp, but none of this means that there's an actual invasion happening yet. The real front of the big population of these fish is actually about 50 miles directly southwest of Chicago in the Illinois River. And so far, because of a lot of the work that's happening right now, we're holding the line on the location of those fish. So there have been a few individuals found, but there's no evidence that there's an established invasion, which is good news as long as we take advantage of the time we've got to actually put preventive steps in place and stop these fish from moving any further towards the Great Lakes.
We're going to look at that prevention in just a moment. But in terms of the fishing economy in the Great Lakes, how might a carp invasion affect those businesses that rely on Lake Michigan?
The Great Lakes Fishery Commission estimates that the regional fishery, most of which is sport fishing, so the kind that would be really devastated by carp invasion, is valued at around $5 billion of annual economic impact. So it is a huge deal, particularly for states with, you know, hundreds of miles of shoreline and hundreds of communities that depend on recreation and tourism. These are places that could potentially really feel the impacts of a fishery, of a die-off of a native species, for example. You're seeing some of that play out right now for other reasons with the collapse of the whitefish fishery, which is devastating both commercial fishing and sport fishing alike. So in the Great Lakes Basin, fishing is a big deal, not just because it is valued at $5 billion, and not just because we can have a commercial operation to take advantage of it, but this is a tradition that people pass down through their families, right? You know, I grew up fortunately being able to go out on a very small rowboat in Lake Huron and had the chance to fish when I was a kid. There are, you know, thousands of people across the region like me who've had that generations of connection to the Great Lakes. And those are the kinds of experiences and that sort of culture that's really at the root of who we are, outdoor lifestyle here, that are at risk when we talk about the impacts of invasive species.
We're talking with Joel Brummeyer, the president and CEO of the Alliance for the Great Lakes, as we look at the threats invasive carp pose to the Great Lakes and what is being done to stop them. Let's now talk about the technology to stop the invasive carp, the Brandon Road Interbasin Project. It's been in the works for several years to stop the fish from entering Lake Michigan. How would this project work?
The first thought when we sat down, and this is decades ago, thinking about how do you stop invasive species from getting from the Mississippi River into the Great Lakes is to look at the Chicago area, because there's a network of canals and rivers that connects the Mississippi River to Lake Michigan. With that comes locks and dams, right? And so there's a site called the Brandon Road Lock and Dam, southwest of the city of Chicago, right near where the Des Plaines and the Illinois River come together. And this provides sort of a ready-made spot where the canal narrows down and you can start to install technologies and change lock operations in an effort to stop critters who aren't supposed to be there from being able to swim through the lock and get into the waters that are close to Lake Michigan. So the Brandon Road Lock and Dam project will create a new channel near that lock. It'll install a whole host of technologies in that channel that can deter fish from moving. It'll change how the lock operates so it can make it really hard for something to swim through. And all that combined will dramatically reduce the risk that bighead and silver carp can move any further towards the Great Lakes.
And with these technologies, I mean, it's a multifaceted approach. In some respects, I'm thinking, like, throw it out there, see what works. I mean, because you got the electric barriers, you got the bubble curtain, the boat ramps and washing stations, and, of course, electric barrier. Why such a mix of approaches here?
Well, the engineering reason is we're talking about reducing risk, right? And so every additional layer of protection means less risk that a fish can get through. So if they get through an acoustic barrier and they hit the electricity, that may stop them. If they get through two of the barriers and they hit the third bubble barrier, that may stop them. If they make it to the lock, right, the very few that might get there are going to be washed out through the modified lock operation, right? So adding all those technologies on top of each other creates much better protection than what we have right now, which is a single experimental electrical barrier further up in the system. This is a custom designed system. It has been in the works for decades. It is authorized by Congress. It's being funded by Congress and two of the Great Lakes states, Illinois and Michigan, with the support of the whole region. It's really great. It has been great to see such a consensus built across these states with, you know, different political leadership, different members of Congress all saying, yeah, this is the place where we can make our stand and make sure that we are doing the best we can to minimize the risk that this happens. And we're hopeful to see that project move forward and being built as fast as possible.
The project is political. In 2023, estimated to cost over $1 billion. You know, 3 years later, what is happening with the funding for Brandon Road?
Well, there's some good news. The good news is that the states of Michigan and Illinois each put up nearly $100 million combined to pay for their local share of the project. In 2022, Congress appropriated a little more than $200 million for its initial share of the project. So that was for what we call phase one construction. And so all the money that is needed to complete phase one construction has already been appropriated and provided. That's really good news. Unfortunately, we've also seen some delays recently where some grants have been held back from the federal government. There has been some delays in contracting that are actually preventing the project from moving forward. But we also know that the support for this project is near universal. And so those delays have been frustrating, but that phase one money has all been in place. And in fact, construction kicked off at the beginning of 2025. So Earth's already moving, you know, technologies are already starting to be, you know, put in the water, and we're excited about keeping this project moving forward.
Has construction paused since the Army Corps of Engineers paused its funding?
Yeah, so the Corps, under direction of the White House and the administration's leadership, has paused contracting for reviews at the high level of the federal government, which has been frustrating because to our knowledge, there are a couple contracts that are being held up that has delayed contracting. It hasn't delayed construction yet, but relatively soon, if those contracts don't get signed, the Corps is going to have to go back and sort of do its procurement process all over again, which is going to add another 6 months to this project unnecessarily. Again, because, you know, the contracts are ready to go and the money's already there. Bigger picture, if you step back, last year, the president said that this project is supposed to move forward with all speed and efficiency. We know that that's not happening right now, but one of the benefits of that could be that we could actually start phase two construction later this year if Congress appropriates additional money. But again, if you're facing these contracting problems and you've got internal reviews at this high level of the federal government that are holding things up, it's going to make it difficult to move the project forward as fast as it should be moving for the Great Lakes.
Outside of these phases of the project, an individual might be wondering, what can I as a fisher do to help prevent the spread of invasive carp into Lake Michigan? Is there anything?
There's always something you can personally do, and a couple very different options. One, whether you're an angler or you enjoy outdoor recreation in some other way, you just care about the Great Lakes, it is important to tell your elected officials how important this project is to you. The reason it's gotten this far is because there's broad public support across the Great Lakes region for a project that's nationally important. But another, more practical, close to home thing you can do is, if you're a boater or an angler, just be really aware when you're moving your vessel from one water body to another, right? Wash your hull off, check your lines, make sure you're not moving plant matter or other, sort of detritus from water body to water body on your fishing lines. Keeping your operation clean, the one that you keep in your garage or you keep in your slip, that is a great way to make sure that you're not part of the problem and actually moving live critters from one place to another and spreading them around. Whether it's the Great Lakes or the Mississippi River Basin or wherever you like to go, that's something you can do to make sure that you're being part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Joel, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, and thanks for chatting about the Great Lakes.
Joel Brummeyer is CEO of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. We learned about efforts to block invasive carp from reaching the Great Lakes as the Army Corps of Engineers pauses funding for the carp project that is under construction. Coming up after three decades, Madison Symphony Orchestra conductor John DeMain looks back on his career and shares a new memoir.
What I wanted to do during my time here was to make people comfortable coming to a concert. And it was okay if you knew a lot about it, and it was okay if you didn't know a lot about it. Just come and listen and enjoy it.
That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In his last season, after three decades with the Madison Symphony Orchestra, Grammy and Tony Award-winning conductor John DeMain is out with a new memoir. Co-authored with the late music journalist Greg Hetmansberger, the memoir walks the reader through DeMain's musical journey and his road to Wisconsin. John DeMain is music director of the Madison Symphony Orchestra and principal conductor of the Madison Opera. His new book is called Working with My Heroes, A Life in Music. He talked to Rob Ferret yesterday.
I want to start in your early days reading about young John DeMain. It seemed very clear that you were destined for a life in music. Could you tell us a little bit about your early days and your earliest love of performing and conducting music?
Well, when I was two, I discovered that I had a really good boy soprano, and I sang in the choir loft with the ladies' choir at the Italian church. And then when I was six, I started taking piano lessons, primarily to accompany myself because I love to sing so much. And by the time I was 9 years old, I played A Mall and the Night Visitors, the Giancarlo Menotti Christmas opera, and I played my own audition and sang the leading role. And in school, we didn't have a string program in the Catholic schools, but we had a band program. And the conductor was the conductor of the symphony and a very, very fine conductor. And he sort of took me under wing, and he was my mentor. His name was Michael Ficicelli. And even in fourth grade, when he couldn't make the band practice, I would conduct the band. So I've been conducting since fourth grade, just on instinct. And all through high school, I was conducting at the community theater doing Broadway musicals. The first one I worked on was Paint Your Wagon, then Brigadoon, then Most Happy Fella, and shows like that, which, gave me a lot of experience. Even though it was community theater, it gave me a head start. And people recognized my talent, so they gave me a chance to do all of this. So I was I was taking private piano lessons and practicing the piano and doing this conducting. And I was conducting a lot, and it was mostly on instinct without any real training except what I observed. And then when I got out of high school, well, at the end of my senior year in high school, I won this piano competition and made my debut with the Youngstown Symphony Orchestra playing the Beethoven First Piano Concerto. And I was so inspired by that, that I think it's what led me to make a decision to go on in music. I mean, I had so many interests. You know, I had a good grade point average. I was interested in medicine, political science. I mean, there were a lot of things that I thought I'd like to get into. And then finally, you know, and I couldn't make up my mind. And in March of my senior year, I looked in the mirror and I said, what is it you do when you don't have to do anything? You're always making music of some kind or another. So maybe that's who you are and that's what you should do. So then I applied to Juilliard and, you know, I got accepted, and then everything happened after that.
We'll dig into some of those stories after Juilliard. Now, though, I want to hear the story behind this memoir. This is years in the making. You were encouraged by your wife, who passed away about 6 years ago. What is the story behind Working with My Heroes?
Well, you know, I just had this sort of interesting career where one thing led to another, and I was all of a sudden working with these, you know, at Houston Grand Opera, we suddenly had Hal Prince, who was the big Broadway director of the time. We suddenly were doing Stephen Sondheim's show, Sweeney Todd, and at Houston Grand Opera. We were when Philip Glass first came on the scene, all of a sudden I was conducting the American premiere of one of his operas, Akhenaten, to be specific. And so, and then when I did Porgy and Bess, and Leonard Bernstein came, then I worked with him on his first opera. And so, you know, just one thing led to another, but I was just working with all these people. And when I was working in summer stock in the summers, earning my way through Juilliard, I was conducting people like Ethel Merman. And eventually I did the first major revival of Hello, Dolly for Carol Channing. And so just one thing just led into another. And I was working with all these people that I'd read about. You know, and then all of a sudden I'm working with them. And it was fun. I mean, I realized that, you know, when you're conducting opera and you're working in the theater, it's very much a collaborative situation, kind of a collaborative art form. So you're working with these people. And of course, you just, you know, try not to be in awe of them because of who they are, but you just go in there and you do the work. And of course, you find out when you work with these incredibly talented people that that's what they do. You know, whatever the publicity, the press, whatever you think about the egos, when you get into that room with them and you're working on a project, it's all about the work. And so that's why I came up with the title of Working with My Heroes.
I want to be Wisconsin selfish here and zoom in on your decision to come to the Madison Symphony Orchestra. You had a successful career. You, as you said, worked with big names in Houston and elsewhere. When this opening showed up in Madison and you came, you auditioned, what appealed to you about that opportunity?
Well, I was frustrated because when I first got into conducting, one of my first jobs was with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, with the Norwalk Symphony. So I was doing orchestral conducting, but then I got this incredible opportunity in Houston. And Houston was a major company, which had a lot of publicity around it. And so I was doing, you know, I did John Adams' first opera, Nixon in China. I did Leonard Bernstein's first opera. So The Quiet Place and other pieces like that, the world premieres. And I got, you know, you get, in America, you get typed. He's an opera conductor. And because in America, we have separate organizations raising money to keep these various arts organizations alive, where in Europe, it's all under one umbrella. So you tend then to get pigeonholed. So I was the longer I was doing opera, the less I was getting the opportunity to do anything orchestral. And that frustrated me because I remember how much I loved my time with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and how much I loved orchestral music. So I really wanted to have a symphony orchestra, but, you know, I was in my 40s and there was just no way I was going to get a major orchestra without having years of experience behind me in symphonic repertoire. The years of experience in opera was great, but it didn't equate over to symphonic repertoire. So I knew I would have to go to an orchestra that was not a major orchestra, but an orchestra that was professional. It was important to me. You know, it had to be a professional orchestra. And so when I, the agent that I had at the time, Scott George in New York, mentioned to me that the Madison Symphony was looking for a new music director and that it was in healthy shape financially, which, of course, was very important as well. And so I looked into it and I came up and I heard the orchestra play for the world premiere of the Frank Lloyd Wright opera.
Shining Brow, yep.
Shining Brow. And that made me feel like I could make a difference and I could bring something to the orchestra. I liked the community right away, and I had a two-year-old daughter, and I thought, why, what a great place for her to grow up. And that's, of course, exactly what happened. So I auditioned. I was very fortunate enough to get hired, and the rest is history for the last 32 years.
John DeMaine is with us, longtime music director of the Madison Symphony Orchestra, principal conductor of the Madison Opera. We're talking about his new memoir. It's called Working with My Heroes, A Life in Music. John, one of my big takeaways from the book is I would assume that these job titles are music jobs. And what I learned from your book is they are people jobs, whether that's dealing with the musicians, whether it's dealing with Leonard Bernstein and talking him down in some cases, outreach to the public. This is very much a job that involves negotiating and working with people. Tell us a little bit about how you approach that side of the job.
It's interesting. That's a very interesting question. You know, I think because you know, I mean, if you're in fourth grade and you're standing up in front of your colleagues and conducting them, you know, I mean, how do you do that and still be a peer, you know, friend? And the same thing in eighth grade, I was going up and playing for the high school. And in high school, I was putting on St. Patrick's Day shows because it was a Catholic high school. I mean, I put on 12 St. Patrick's Day extravaganzas over my lifetime. The bishop used to come. I used to stage them, choreograph them, play for them. And so I was like, and then, and we had never done a musical before. So senior year in high school, we did Oklahoma. And I played Curly, but I also was the music director and musical director. And I put an orchestra in the pit, and I had our band director conduct the show. But the point is that I was like a faculty person, and at the same time, I was a colleague. You know, I was a classmate. And I had to learn how to talk and deal so that I could do those things. And I do think that there's no question there's lessons to be learned about how to deal with a major orchestra. And how to, you know, how to say please and thank you, and how to understand how their behavior is. And I think that when you're working with singers, for example, I mean, you have to invest them with love. And I noticed that, you know, somebody like Leonard Bernstein, who could part the Red Seas in New York, you know, when he would go anywhere, you know, I mean, he was just such a colossal personality. But when you worked with him in the room, he infused that room with love and enthusiasm. And because, I mean, first of all, that's how you get the best performance out of people, is to think that you love them rather than hate them. You know, but it's more sincere than that. And it creates a wonderful working atmosphere. And also it's how you get results. So you have to learn how to deal with people. And, you know, I mean, as far as conductors are concerned, we know from the era of Toscanini that conductors were like dictators. I mean, they could be abusive and horrible, but we can't do that today. And if you want to have a career in this business, you can't be abusive. And I understand that, and I've learned that over the lifetime of my own career. But also, you know, I think if I've had any kind of success in Madison, it's because when we go to work, it's about the work, and we don't pick on personalities, or we don't, you know, play games like that. We just, you know, I celebrate my orchestra because every one of them could play their instrument better than I ever could. So, I mean, you know, you come into this room with all these great people from a point of respect,
And then you get what you want, but you get it as, you know, with politeness and courtesy and firmness, but it's all coming from a point of respect. And when you work that way, you get it back.
You've got the memoir, you're wrapping up your career with the symphony. As you are reflecting now, what do you hope that your colleagues in the community remember the John Demain era at the Madison Symphony for?
Ooh, well, first of all, we've covered a lot of repertoire that the orchestra hadn't played before, and the orchestra also grew into this phenomenal virtuosic instrument that it is now. I mean, I just had rehearsal last night and was just blown away at how fast they can play the most difficult music and how they've what they've become. And of course, it's during my lifetime that Overture Center for the Arts was built during my time here. And I know that I was one of the reasons why they decided to give us a first-class hall, because we didn't have one when I came. And we didn't really have a place to perform music that was acceptable. And so now we have one of the world's great centers for the arts. And so I'm so grateful to Pleasant and rest his soul, Jerry Fauci, for what they have done and are doing and continue to do for Madison. But I think, you know, what I wanted to do during my time here was to make people comfortable coming to a concert. You know, there are people who come to the concert who are so sophisticated in their knowledge of music and opinionated. And there's other people who just like to listen to it and don't really know much about what they're listening to. And for me, I wanted to make, it's like going to church and meeting the preacher afterwards, you know, and I wanted them to feel comfortable with me, comfortable with hearing music, and just, you know, and it was okay if you knew a lot about it, and it was okay if you didn't know a lot about it. Just come and listen and enjoy it. And I've enjoyed meeting the patrons and donors over these years, because this community is a community of a lot of achievers, as you know. I mean, there's people with incredible patents and, you know, Nobel Prizes, and, you know, just a tremendous amount of creativity and wealth and in the community. And so by our system of working with donors to collect, you know, money to perform and to raise funds and all of that, you get to meet all these people. In Europe, you don't, because it's all subsidized by the government. So you can live in an ivory tower, go to your concert, and go back into your ivory tower. But you can't do that in America. You have to have a relationship. And I think the relationships that I developed with our audience over the years has been particularly meaningful and wonderful. And of course, I love the musicians, and that's the most important thing. And the fact that they still laugh at my jokes after 32 years, it's sort of great for me.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That is John Demain, music director of the Madison Symphony Orchestra and principal conductor of the Madison Opera. His new memoir is titled Working with My Heroes, A Life in Music. He spoke with Rob Ferret. We asked you how you feel about colleges beginning to offer 3-year baccalaureate degrees and programs that used to take students 4 years to complete. Jeff in Madison emailed to say that during the Vietnam era, many Wisconsinites attended the UW when tuition and housing costs roughly equaled the average amount of income that a college student could earn during a 3-month summer vacation. Jeff concludes that we should go back to this standard and putting young people into an unfathomable pit of debt for a basic university education has damaged our society. Thanks for writing in, Jeff. You can share your perspective on 3-year degrees. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. Again, 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Joe Tarr, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.